For program information, audio, video, and more, head to the RN homepage.
Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're so very welcome to Books and Arts on podcast, radio, and the ABC Radio app. Today, three outstanding women. The acclaimed Australian actress Robin Nevin reveals the challenges of playing one of the great roles, Mother Courage.
Survival is her absolute sole aim each morning as she gets up. She's the ultimate survivor, and I suppose that kind of resilience in the face of such ongoing horror could be considered courageous.
And telling an Irish story, the Melbourne actress Vanessa O'Neill takes us into one of the smallest theatres in Australia, the legendary La Mama, for her new one-woman show. But first, let's meet the woman of the hour. Oh yes, Australia's most prestigious award for fiction, the Miles Franklin, was presented last night at the State Library of Victoria from a terrific shortlist, unusually dominated by women. And da-da-da-da-da-da! Sophie Laguna has prevailed. She's taken out the $60,000 prize for her novel, The Eye of the Sheep, and she's here with me, glowing in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Did you think you were in with a chance?
Oh, it's a complicated thing, isn't it? I didn't think that I was going to win. I don't know if that's...
Oh, shucks.
But I knew technically I was in with a chance, which makes it all the more nerve-wracking.
Do you know beforehand?
You don't know beforehand.
Oh, you don't know?
So I found out at the same time that the rest of the country
the
found out.
The winner is...
Yes, yes.
Oh, how exciting.
Yes.
So for those who haven't read the book, The Eye of the Sheep, mm-hmm. briefly, what's it about?
It's narrated by a boy called Jimmy Flick. So when the story opens, he's 6 years old. He lives in Altona with his parents.
Which is a working class suburb of Melbourne.
It's an industrial suburb.
Yes.
And his dad is Gavin, and his dad works at the Mobil oil refinery. Mum is Paula. He has a brother, Robbie. He has, in today's way of talking about children and difficulties, and I suppose he's on the spectrum, or he has learning difficulties. As the author, I never made those kind of decisions about him. But his father finds him very difficult to manage, and his mother is his lifeline. And his father, partly because of the struggle with Jimmy, drinks, and he becomes violent with Mum on the weekends when he drinks too much. Although, again, I never understood the story exactly in those terms. I was simply identifying with the little boy. He didn't see his father as violent. He had much more poetic, original ways of understanding this.
How do you mean you didn't see the story in those terms? Do you mean you didn't quite know what you were writing?
Meaning the story requires that I be identified with my protagonist. So if I am truly aligned with him and identifying with a six-year-old boy, he has no concept of alcoholism or violence. I'm in there looking at the world and at his parents through his eyes, so I'm describing it in the way that he might. And that is, I think, how the voice can be its most authentic.
Right. And he loves reading instruction manuals.
He does. Toasters and hair dryers and ovens and fridges, yeah.
See, the scary thing is I actually get this.
That is scary.
I actually understand how interesting it is to think, I see, that fits there and this fits there, and you mustn't switch it on while the cover's on it, and you should take the cover off. And
maybe it's the order. Maybe there's something reassuring about those diagrams and making things
work.
Yeah,
because if life is like a toaster, then you can make sense of everything.
Exactly. But unfortunately, it's not. And so many circumstances are outside of Jimmy's control, and so much is difficult for him.
There's such an interesting sense of the way the men relate to each other in the family. Where did you get access to that?
so much of it, Michael, is unconscious. So it, you know, I suppose authors are using all the life that we've lived, and it sort of all goes through this giant filtering system, and comes out in, almost in a stream of consciousness on the page. Where did Gavin come from? Well, we lived in Altona, so we lived near that mobile oil refinery, and I found that structure very compelling and very charged, and I was it played a big part in the book itself, and that was where Gavin worked. And
actually, Altona is a kind of galvanizing place for people who don't know Altona. It's actually on the water, so in one sense, it's quite beautiful because there's a beach and houses that overlook the ocean. But down to your right, basically, is the refinery.
That's
so there's
exactly
this kind
it.
Of well, you could see it as ugly, or you could see it as kind of muscular and urban and fundamental.
You are doing a better job than I am of describing it, but that is exactly it. And it's the juxtaposition or the contradiction between nature and its gentleness and its beauty and all those birds, and then that raw power of the industry. And I didn't find it repelling or ugly. But it had its own kind of beauty, the way you described it. And it was the way that the two sat alongside each other that created such an interesting tension for me. And perhaps that is a tension that is all the way there through the story. Nature as opposed to something more modern or more worked or more difficult.
Well, it goes to this issue about what you find beautiful, doesn't it? Which is such an issue at the moment because of this fuss about wind farms, you know, with the Prime Minister saying he finds wind farms ugly. Well, you know, it looked at one way, a big area of oil tanks, great big tanks full of petroleum is ugly. But if you think about what it takes to run a city, the fact that right there is a refinery and there is petrol and the system works, there is a kind of muscularity to it that you can find thrilling.
That's it. But it was the structure too, Michael, that was thrilling. So, you know, those old, you know, astronaut helmets in the very old days, or, you know, those giant iron kind of round things with the grid in the front. Those big tanks looked like them turned upside down with ladders twisting around, sort of like candy, but rusted metal, and all these crisscrossing pipes and these billowing grey smoke charging up into the clouds and sort of mixing with the clouds. So you couldn't tell cloud from smoke. That I found very interesting. And this flame that was always there. And that plays a big part in the story, the flame that never dies. That's kind of an important symbol in the story. So I without even, again, being conscious of it, there it came out in this book.
Sophie Laguna is my guest here this morning, and she's here. Well, she's here because she's interesting, but she's here because she's the woman of the hour.
A lot of pressure, woman of the hour.
I know, but you know, the media's like that. We've got to hype things.
Okay.
Well, it's not hard to hype you. You've just won the Miles Franklin Award, for heaven's sake. I have to say something a bit swish about it all. So since you wrote this book, you've become a mum.
I was a mum while I wrote the book, Michael, because I've got my first son, Sonny, who is now 4.5.
Okay.
And I've since had another baby, Milo, who is 8 months. So I wrote the book. I think I began to write the book when Sonny was about 18 months, and then finished it, was he three, something like that? So a lot of it was written in play centres. And if you have a small child, you will know what a play centre is all about. They're these sort of giant warehouses full of plastic toys and tubes for kids to roam in.
And noise.
And noise. But noise is not necessarily a bad thing for writing. No, it can focus a person, and it kind of, you have to work against the noise, and somehow that can sharpen your focus.
So you create your own little astronaut's helmet,
yes.
Do you?
Yes. Oh, what a wonderful way to put it. Yes. So, a big quiet space and a stretch of 10 hours in front of you can be much more intimidating than 45 minutes in a play centre.
Right.
So the work that one can produce in a short amount of time can be quite distilled, I think, because you access deeper parts of the unconscious much more quickly when you have the containment around the time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
So does having Sonny help you, does it make it somehow easier to write the book. Well, easy is a silly word. Does it focus your attention in a way that perhaps you wouldn't do if you had all the time in the world?
I would have. If having time in the world, no, I can't. You know, that is lovely, and one gets more time to daydream and rest. So I was tired a lot of the time, but it does help as well. It does help as well because it. You know, when so much of your energy is going into domestics and parenting and mothering, it is wonderful to have another reality full of strange characters who you don't quite know where they've come from, who you're constantly getting to know better to escape to.
Maybe writer's block is a luxury you can't afford to have.
That's exactly it.
When you've got a child.
There's no time for writer's block. So literally you might have 45 minutes. So I say to myself, Sophie, 500 words, no question, that is what has to be done right now.
Because actually the most important thing in your life is not the book.
That's it. It's the both of them, by far.
Yeah.
By far. So what's the expression? Lowers the ante or it relaxes the whole thing somehow?
I don't know what the expression is.
I don't know either. But
it's
a good mix. The only downside is tiredness. But all my friends here are hearing a lot about that.
Well, you're looking pretty sprightly today and you've probably been up all night.
I have.
Yeah. So you trained as an actor.
I did.
At the VCA, the Victorian College of the Arts.
Yes.
Have you laid that aside or is that acting training still with you as you write, as you enter into all these voices and characters?
It must still be there. I suppose everything I've done is still there. And you know that, well, for many years I've written for children and I continue to write for children. And one thing that authors who write for children do is to go into schools and work with students. And I would act out my first picture book as a one-woman show. So I've done that for children all over Australia, the My Yellow Blankie Show. And I'm having to do a lot of public speaking, so I'm sure the acting experience is coming in.
Well, you know, when you first spoke about your book, your now award-winning book here on Books and Arts, you spoke to Suzanne Donisthorpe.
I did.
And I was listening to the interview again last night, and there was a reading, and I thought, oh, we got an actor in to read your bit because the reading was so evocative.
Oh,
and then I realised it was you.
Thank you.
So all the voices and the sense of characterisation and the ability to vocalise that, that's in you. And I guess that must enhance the way in which you hear voice when you're sitting there writing away in the first place.
Well, it's difficult to say. It's the chicken or the egg, isn't it? What was it that drew me to acting in the first place? It is those voices and those impulses. So, has the training helped? Anything that's immersed me in character and given me the opportunity to play in that way is a good thing, I suppose.
Yeah. There's a link to that interview on our website, by the way. If you just pop along to the story now, you'll find a link to the interview with Sophie. In fact, we've put links to all the people we've spoken to. We've spoken to the entire shortlist, it turns out, so they're all there. You can catch up with them all. Now, the Miles Franklin Award, which you've won, celebrates writing that is about Australian life in any of its phases. Were you conscious of telling, well, I suppose you were, an Australian story because it's an Altona story?
That's right. Not at the time, but it is an Altona story. It is about, we were talking about the Altona's location. So there's a lot of protected wetlands in Altona. So again, there is that industry off to the back of those wetlands, the Truganina wetlands, and off to the back and to the right. But these wetlands are filled with the most beautiful birds. How extraordinary. The coastline of Altona, there are up to hundreds of black swans for certain parts of the year.
So our country, our voices, our stories.
That's right. And also quite a secret sort of a place. A place
our
that we, that we don't hear enough about. We don't hear enough about.
Yeah.
Who would have thought industrial Melbourne, 25 minutes from the city, hundreds and hundreds of swans, and not only swans, but pelicans. Pelicans, birds that you associate I associate with northern New South Wales, great flocks of them as you're driving home past this refinery.
I know. I always wonder how they don't bump into each other, a flock of pelicans. Look out, chaps.
So the pelicans play a part in the story too.
It's called The Eye of the Sheep. It's just won the Miles Franklin Award. Sophie Laguna is the author. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me.
A wonderful achievement. And as I say, you can find audio of a long interview with Sophie Laguna with Suzanne Donisthorpe. It's a lovely, warm conversation. And in fact, there are conversations with all of the authors who are on the shortlist for the Miles Franklin there on our website. This is Books and Arts on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. Next up, Robin Nevin stars in a new production of Bertolt Brecht's classic play, Mother Courage.
Gott sei Dank geht alles schnell vorüber, auch die Liebe und der Kummer sogar. Wo sind die Tränen von gestern Abend? Wo ist der Schnee vom vergangenen Jahr?
That's the German actor Gisela May winding down there, performing the song of Mother Courage, music by Paul Dessau, written for the original 1941 production of Mother Courage and Her Children by the German theatre maker Bertolt Brecht. It is one of the great anti-war plays of all time, you'd have to say, and the title role, I guess, is one of the great roles for a woman. It's playing now at the Belvoir in Sydney, and Robin Nevin is playing Mother Courage. Robin Nevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Pleasure to be here, my first time.
It's a treat to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Eamon Flack is the director. Hi, Eamon.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Is it your first time too?
It is my first time, yes.
Welcome aboard.
Two virgins.
Oh, how lovely. I don't know where to go with that. I'll tell you what, I've got a good quiz question, though. If you were at a theatre night, a great quiz question would be, who is Anna Feeling?
Well, I know who she is.
Yes, but I wonder whether many people do, because we just think of her as Mother Courage, don't we?
I think that's true, yes. And her name is only mentioned once in our text, anyway. I say it very loudly and very clearly.
This is who I am.
Yes.
So, Eamon, there will be people who don't know the play. So just briefly, what's it about, Mother Courage?
It's about a woman and her family who run a canteen cart during, like in the original setting, during the 30 Years' War. And it's about that woman trying to keep her family alive at the same time as carry on making a living.
Yes, and really? She just doesn't. Yep. She's sort of indomitable, really. She just keeps trudging on. And what's the context in which he wrote it? Was there a kind of political environment that motivated him to write this?
Yeah. Adolf Hitler was about to declare war against the entire world at the time that Brecht started to write this play, and he didn't finish the play until the other side of that war. So it's got this very kind of complicated sense of disgust about it, but also this deep sense of sorrow, I think, at the same time. And, you know, on the one hand, it's kind of ostensibly an anti-capitalist play, but on the other hand, I think it's much bigger than that.
Oh, yes, it's an anti-war play in the round, isn't it? I mean, it's just, you don't have a sense that this is a war being waged by capitalists. You just have a sense that war is a kind of pointless and destructive, violent business.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's a sort of good communist and a good socialist and a good Marxist, in his account of war, and I think he sticks fairly closely to, you know, to what Marx argued about the way in which war and capitalism are kind of intricately allied. But at the same time, I think the real value of the play is about the way it talks about the human qualities that tend to kind of rise to the top when we're living in times of chaos. And those aren't the qualities we like to think are the great human qualities necessarily.
Mm. Robin, can we talk about Mother Courage herself? I mean, the word courage is so interesting, isn't it, really? What do you read into that word that's been, that label that's been put on her by the playwright?
Yes, that's an interesting question. Well, in the play, she says poor people must have courage. Everything's against them, getting up in the morning, even that takes courage. She's operating at the bottom, at the grind of war, and survival is her absolute sole aim each morning as she gets up to face each day in a war zone. She's the ultimate survivor, and I suppose that kind of resilience in the face of such ongoing horror could be considered courageous.
But it could also be considered slightly mad.
Well, yes. I mean, war is mad. Isn't it mad? Isn't it a mad world in a war zone? I mean, we have examples of this all the time. People coming back from wars descend into a terrible kind of madness. It's yes, I feel a bit a bit imbued with that kind of madness myself, Michael. I'm doing 8 shows a week of it.
Well, I know. I was just looking at the season. So you started, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, and you're running through until the 26th of July.
Yes, as an actor in this world, as very much an ensemble, everyone shares the burden of responsibility of this large and intense piece of work and has a lot of joy in the doing of it. as an actor, you have to take great care of yourself, physically, mentally, and emotionally, because that way can lie madness.
She's on stage the whole time. I think there's one scene when she's not on stage.
Yes, she's the penultimate scene. She's not in when her daughter dies by gunshot. She's not there present for that, which is probably why her daughter dies, of course. She's off haggling somewhere. Yeah, and I have a lot of water during that time.
Or you hydrate, as we say now. No one drinks anymore. People hydrate or rehydrate.
Oh, really?
Oh yes.
Well,
it's important to hydrate.
I have a little personal prop, which is a small brandy flask. It looks like brandy. It's peppermint tea, and I drink that throughout the night.
Keeps you going.
Yes.
So, Robin, how have you built this character? What are the elements that you've drawn together into your body and your voice to make her vibrant?
Oh, it's a really hard question. I just started on day one and went from there, really. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to describe, building a character. I think as you approach each scene, you start again, especially in Brecht, because even though there is a continuity, each scene is kind of discrete in itself. And you just play out the actions. One action follows another, and you do what those actions demand of you.
But how do you find a voice, vocally, for example? Where does the voice come from? Do you try things out, or do you hear her straight away?
No, I don't hear her straight away. And I had a bit of a struggle finding the kind of roughness. So that's what I consciously did try to land, a kind of roughness, just to get away from, well, to find a roughness.
Yeah.
And that takes a lot out of you vocally, so I have to do a lot of... I'm a bit ropey in the middle of the day, speaking in the morning, but by night I'm pretty warmed up. I have a lot of warm-up work to do physically and vocally for this, to keep fit and supple and able to reach the kind of variety of notes that I attempt to reach.
So you've played... you played Cleopatra, Shakespeare's Cleopatra. You played Blanche Dubois... Tennessee Williams. How does this rate alongside those roles as a role for an actress to take on?
Well, I played Queen Lear, and I thought that's Lear, Shakespeare's Lear, King Lear, but as a queen.
Yeah.
And I think this is harder, but it doesn't have the poetic range.
Yes, I'd forgotten about Queen Lear, but it does take you to the same kind of...
limits.
Yeah, limits, the emotional limits of a character who is surrounded by a landscape and a world that's utterly debased and ruinous.
Well, Lear gets to howl. Mother Courage doesn't get to howl. She's not given that opportunity.
I
think that makes a big difference, yeah. It's a very emotional final scene of Lear and his daughter.
Mm.
But Mother Courage doesn't have that emotional outlet, really. There's a lullaby at the end, but it's not emotional. So it's a very different kind of experience. Yeah. But the burden of the role is, I mean... In a way, I think Katrine, the dumb daughter, and the chaplain are the two choice roles. Mother Courage has the burden of, just kind of charging through each scene and pushing it and driving it and explaining stuff. And that's like the character, really.
Mm.
It's burdensome. But there's joy in the ensemble, the nature of the ensemble, which is where I'm happiest.
So, Amon, you come along and here you are directing a play which has been done thousands of times probably. Are you thinking, what can I bring to this play which is new and fresh, or are you looking for something that's grounded in its traditions?
No, I don't necessarily look to either, to be honest. I just kind of read it and spend a long, long time trying to understand what in the play is going to mean something to us and what in the play isn't going to mean something to us. Because it was written for... It was first performed for a group of people who had just survived a complete annihilation. And that's not our experience in Sydney at the moment of the world. And so I don't... I just sort of think much more in terms of how to make sense of the immediate meaning of the play from moment to moment. And I don't look at other productions ever, actually, when I'm working on something.
Oh, you don't?
No.
See, I always find that odd when people say that. I would have thought that you'd want to look at everything that's ever been done so that you could have a sense of what history had made of this play and what you could bring to it and what you could learn from the past.
I mean, it's interesting how much you kind of know that stuff anyway, somehow or other. Like, you get exposed to the famous productions at drama school somehow, and you're aware of it. There's no way around that. And there's always, like, people always bring that knowledge to you anyway. Like working with Michael Gow, for example, who's such a kind of thorough researcher and, you know, like, I think really loves that work. I felt like Michael supplied me with everything that I needed to know in many ways.
So Michael Gow's done the translation for this, has he?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? So
yes.
Michael Gow is an Australian playwright and he's done the translation, I see. On RN, this is Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart, and we're talking about Belvoir's new production of Mother Courage by Bertolt Brecht, and with me in the studio are Robin Nevin, who plays Mother Courage, and the director of the show, Eamon Flack. Robin, on that question of whether you expose yourself to other performances and other productions and so on when you're preparing a role, either as an actor or a director, where do you fall on that?
I'm with Eamon. I don't think it's helpful because you're beginning again with each production, you're beginning again with a group of people you may or may not have worked with before. And beginnings are always fearfully difficult, I think. Day one is so hard. I remember the first time we actually started to stage scene one of this play in Eamon's rehearsal room. And we did it in a fairly kind of lackluster fashion because we just didn't kind of know how to begin. How do you begin? Mm. How do you begin? Are there ground rules? Some people set ground rules. Ours was very free, collaborative kind of room. And I remember feeling so flat and inadequate afterwards. And Eamon kind of went, let's do scene two, which was a very good idea. And then as we moved through the play, that informed scene one. As the whole play informs the final scene, I think, of any play, any great play, especially drama, so does doing the whole play inform the first scene. You kind of know then who you are and what you're doing. But I think beginning is a beginning, and I'm with Eamon.
So it's always new.
It's always new, because as much as possible, you want to work from what's actually happening on the floor with everyone else who's in the room with you, rather than kind of constantly trying to achieve what you'd prepared or researched previously.
But of all playwrights, Brecht is unusual in that he had his own very bold theories about how theatre should work. He talked about what's sometimes called the alienation effect, or the estrangement effect, some people translate it as. Do you have those theories in mind when you're working on a Brecht play?
No, not at all.
But you know about them.
I know about them. And
I mean, it's kind of collective knowledge in the theatre, isn't it?
Yeah, it's collective knowledge in the theatre, but also actually I think that all theatre is Brechtian now and has been for a very, very long time. So the principles are pretty natural to us, I think. When we started working on this play itself, I did continue to discover ways in which what gets called the alienation effect is just there on the page, and to some extent there's no way around it. Like, you just have to kind of do the script, really.
Yeah. I mean, simply put, it seems to me the alienation effect says the play is a story and the audience has to understand they're being told a story. These are not real people and they shouldn't get caught into some kind of sentimental attachment to the people on the stage as if they're real people, because the storiness is where the kind of political engagement lies. Is that a fair summary, do you think?
I think so, but I'm not... I think that probably is a fair summary, but I'm not sure that it really works.
No, I'm not either.
Why not, Robin?
Because I think people just adore Katrine the Dumb Daughter. Of course they do. How could they not when she's shot? I mean, she suffers the slings and arrows, you know, in spades, and then she's killed at the end, and in the process of a very noble, honourable action. She's trying to save lives. Somebody shoots her. So the audience inevitably is moved, and thank God for that.
And Robin, is your Mother Courage funny?
I'm not the best person to ask.
Well, you must know whether people laugh when you drop a line. I mean,
well, yes, it's not received as a comedy. They start laughing in the first scene because the first scene is very vibrant and vital and funny and tricksy. And when I say tricksy, I mean Mother Courage is at her showbiz best in that scene. But the play does follow a dark path, even though there's fantastic music and songs and some levity, of course, and a lot of irony. And Australians love irony. But it's not kind of laugh out loud, gag lines,
no.
Really.
So the music, you've got some new music for the show, Eamon.
Yeah, Stephen Gregory wrote it for us, and not just for the show, actually, but for this particular group of actors.
Well, how did that work? What, he worked with them first, did he?
Stefford worked with quite a lot of the people in the cast. Stefford worked with Robin before and with Tony before, and Steph did spend some time with Robin before we went into rehearsals. And but partly writing very much like, you know, you've got to write to what the script, you know, what the song needs to do in the script, but also really writing to, you know, to our understanding or Steph's understanding of what that actor's voice is,
and that's just such a huge benefit.
Yeah,
is it? He wrote him as wonderful song for Paula Arundel, who's got a fantastic, very beautiful voice. And my songs are very simple, so I don't have any difficulty with the range, and that is a huge benefit.
Now, Eamon, you're about to step up as the artistic director of Belvoir. I think next year you start. Mm-hmm. What objective have you given yourself?
To survive it. First of all,
but you must know. Look, someone's given you a theatre to run. What are you going to do with it? What's going to be your take on what this theatre can be?
Well, you know, Belvoir's always been, I think, a home for acting, really. And I think great actors in great roles is always, like for me, the greatest pleasure of going to the theatre and working in the theatre. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, I think that. We're living in a situation at the moment where the idea of public discussion and the whole notion of public good and of who belongs to what and who gets to speak out and who doesn't is very, very contentious at the moment. And I think that if the arts aren't outspoken, and if a company like Belvoir can't be outspoken and nimble and witty and sort of defiant, then I think we may as well kind of just give up and open a golf club or something, really.
Does that mean it will also be a writer's theatre then?
Yeah, very, very much so. I would love to think that. I mean, I was the literary manager at the company for a while, and I was an actor for a while, and those two things inform my sensibilities very deeply. But at the same time, I also spent... I was born overseas and spent quite a lot of my early life overseas, and that sort of slightly haunting sense of the wider world has never really left me or my family, and continues to be a very big part of my life. And it feels like it would be great to see the Australian stage begin to look less well-dressed and less inner city and less... less nice, I suppose. They're the things that are on my mind a lot as I work towards it. But at the same time, I think that, you know, if you're asking people to pay money to come and see a piece of theatre, then you need to make sure that what you're giving them first and foremost is, is the craft at its best, really. And that's about acting and writing, I think. We'll take a couple of years to get where we're going.
Yeah, no, that sounds like
I'm not in any rush, actually. It sounds I never
like
have been.
Sounds like a great series of objectives. And I hope
doesn't
we get...
it sound like a great series of objectives?
It does.
I'm excited.
We're all signing up, Robin. Well, thank you to the two of you for coming in today. It's been lovely to talk about Mother Courage.
My pleasure. Michael. Thanks, Michael.
I should ask you, Robin, do you like to be called an actress or are you an actor?
Yes. No, I'm an actress.
You're an
actress.
Well,
I'm both, but I call myself an actress.
Actress Robin Nevin and director Eamon Flack with the Belvoir production of Bertolt Brecht's classic Mother Courage and Her Children. It's on now and it runs until the 26th of July. Across Australia, this is RN. You're listening to Books and Arts.
Now, as a background briefing podcast, what is sacred?
When you go to church, you pray to the Lord. We haven't got a church. And all these rocks that's got carving on, the Bible is getting ripped apart.
How the government of Western Australia created a new, narrow definition of a sacred site.
Which meant that it could overlook a vast amount of Indigenous heritage in Western Australia that conflicted with resource development.
You can download this background briefing from the RN website.
Yes, it's a wonderful program, that background briefing, well worth listening. And yes, you can indeed download it from the RN website. You're listening to Books and Arts, where it's time now for Top Shelf, and in the hot seat this morning is the Australian lawyer Richard McHugh. Richard's debut novel is called Charlie Anderson's General Theory of Lying, and it's set in the world of Sydney's high-flying bankers and consultants. For Top Shelf today, Richard shares some of his artistic inspirations from other corners of the world.
I'm Richard McHugh. I'm a lawyer and a writer, and this is my Top Shelf. Number one is the Palazzo Farnese in Rome. This is a 16th century Renaissance palace which is near the Campo dei Fiori in Rome. It's the archetype of architecture from that period. Everything about it is perfect to me. The proportions of it are just right, and the history of it is magnificent. It was the palace for one of the cardinals, Alessandro Farnese, who went on to become the Pope. And at that point, he brought in Michelangelo, to help him finish it. And it's now the French embassy in Rome. And if there was anywhere in the world that I could live, it would be that. Out the front, there are two baths from the Baths of Caracalla, which have been turned into fountains, and I just think it's the most perfect place in the world. Number two is a song by a British band called Blur, called Song 2. To me, this is a perfectly constructed guitar pop song. It's actually a satire of grunge music from 1997. It's 2 minutes long, and the lyrics are all nonsense, which was the point of the song. Blur were trying to say that all that listeners care about is a catchy guitar lick, and they were right, because the song went on to be a huge hit and is popular all around the world to this day, almost 20 years later. Number three for me is a really great photograph by Max Dupin called The Sunbaker. I take a lot of photographs myself on film in the square format, and the way Dupin has used the square is just really superb in this photo. The sand in front of the sunbaker goes out of focus, and it gives his arms and his shoulders this monumental abstract quality. And I think, like everyone else in Australia, I spent a lot of time lying on the sand on the beach, and it's a pity for me that this has become a bit of a cliche, because it really is a perfect, quintessentially Australian photograph. Number four is my favourite movie, Apocalypse Now, which was released in 1979.
Charlie's Point! Charlie, don't surf!
Francis Ford Coppola's movie, I think, does more to exploit what is unique in cinema than any other movie I've ever seen. There's a close psychological study of Captain Willard as he goes up the river to assassinate Colonel Kurtz during the Vietnam War, and that is cut up with scenes of the American military expedition getting completely out of control. There's a scene, a completely operatic scene, where helicopters attack a village at the mouth of a river. It's the famous scene where they go surfing, and the complaint is that Charlie don't surf. I think it's the best scene ever shot in cinema. Number five, my favourite book, is Persuasion by Jane Austen. She's an amazing stylist in English, and most of her books are concerned with very pretty young women in the prime of their lives who make silly mistakes. Persuasion is completely different from all of her other books. She's dealing with a character, Anne Elliot, who is older and who has lost her bloom and who has lost her chance in life. And the way she deals with that character, who has a life I think maybe not so different from Jane Austen's, is to me very subtle. And she sets it in a changing world in England, where there's the rise of a new self-made class. The hero is Captain Wentworth. And the satire of society, particularly in Bath, is as perfect as I think you can get in English.
Australian author and lawyer Richard McHugh with his very rich, very thoughtful selection for Top Shelf. And we'll be hearing more from Richard again next week when he joins us to chat about his debut novel, Charlie Anderson's General Theory of Lying, which is published by Penguin Books. On RN, this is Books and Arts. I'm Michael Cathcart. Next up, an actress in search of her family. Now, you may be a person who has a passion for your own family history, and if you are, I wonder if you find that it's a passion which is hard to share with other people. The stories about the arrivals, the marriages, and the children of your forebears give you a sense of your place in the cosmos, but really there is no good reason why they should matter to anyone else.
Well, I'd like you to meet an actress who's been working on a show about her own Irish family history for some years now. In fact, I've been following this work, and I think she's really found a way of making us care by sharing her personal investment in the story. And the great news is that she's found a place in inner Melbourne, which has given her a chance to develop the project. And that place is La Mama Theatre in Carlton, Faraday Street, Carlton. And it's one of the meccas of Australian theatre. And standing out the front is the woman you and I have come here to meet, Vanessa O'Neill. Howdy doody.
Hello, Michael.
Hey, this is exciting. You're on at La Mama.
Ah, I love La Mama.
It's a little, what would we say, a little brown big building. It's two-storey high. It's like something out of a Dickens novel.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. I think, and I love that every time you come and see a show, even though it's such a small space, the space can look completely different, but it always has that wonderful warmth that La Mama has.
And they've been doing plays here since 1967.
I know.
Jack Hibbert was the first playwright performed here.
I think that's wonderful.
As we walk in the front door, tell us a bit about you. You trained as an actor in the old country.
In London, yeah. I trained with Philippe Gollier, kind of physical theatre person, and then I went to a drama school called Drama Centre in London.
Right. And what made you think that acting was your thing?
Well, in truth, I can't remember a time from when I was a little girl where I didn't want to be an actor. It just was the thing.
Oh, there's a lady sitting in here in a pink hat. Who's this?
Oh, this is my director. This is the wonderful Glynis Angel, who is the director and dramaturg on the play that we're currently rehearsing, which is In Search of Owen Roe.
Hello, Michael.
It's so nice to be sitting here. Just let me sit beside you.
Please.
So, listener, you and I are now sitting down in the famous La Mama Theatre.
We are.
Let's try and describe what the interior is like.
This is an ever-shrinking interior because there are so many productions that happen here every year for the last, how many years?
Well, 1967 it started, yeah, right. So do the math, as the Americans say.
That there's so many shows, that, and the interior is often painted and then repainted black for every show, that it is slowly and surely a smaller space.
Yes, it used to be an enormous auditorium, but now it's a closet.
It is. It's small. It's a small space. Yes, 35 seats, and there's a set of stairs. And the office, the administration, actually is situated above us. As we, above the lighting rig, there's a ceiling, and there's an office where about 6, 7, 8 people ferret in and out.
And you can really light this space with, you've got a lot of lights. You've got about half a dozen, but you can actually light it with 2 or 3.
Absolutely. It's a very intimate space, which makes it a very magical space.
Yeah. Now, Vanessa, I'm delighted that you're doing this show because you and I have talked about this over the years and it's been, I know, a labour of love for you. It's called In Search of Owen Roe. Tell us about the genesis of this.
It began when I went in search of my great-grandfather. I just, particularly when I had my own son, who has my last name, there was something about understanding more about my ancestry, particularly my Irish ancestry, and I went looking for my great-grandfather and discovered that he was buried in an unmarked grave, and no one could really explain why.
Whereabouts?
In Perth, at Karrakatta Cemetery. So it was a big thing, it was a big deal to go and look at his grave, you know, see the words that were written to remember him by, and It's actually quite a shock when you go looking for someone's gravestone and find an unmarked grave.
But why him? I mean, I understand, okay, suddenly you've got a child and you start to think about your heritage and you've got this marvellous Irish name, Vanessa O'Neill, that feels very sort of Irish. Why did you pick this grandfather off the family tree? Why was that the branch that you decided to journey to?
Well, I suppose I was always intrigued because there were lots of stories about my great-grandmother. She lived till she was 100, so she's a bit the stuff of legend. But there just seemed to be this obvious gap because, you know, like, who was this great-grandfather? And I suppose because he had such a famous name, so Owen Roe O'Neill, the original Owen Roe O'Neill, is this great leader of the Irish Rebellion in 1642. So I knew about this famous Irish name, and I knew, you know, I've been to Ireland many times and have a particular love for Ireland, and so I was intrigued to know about this man who carries this incredible name, and it seemed that no one knew about him, and actually I think that just made him all the more interesting to me.
So how did you research him?
Well, once I'd found that there was an unmarked grave that no one could explain to me, then I just started that slow process of particularly looking through newspaper reports and articles and that kind of thing. I went, you know, Trove Online is a fantastic resource. made use of the state library resources.
Okay, so you get a lot of historical research together, and you could write an article about it. That's the kind of thing I've done lots of times as a historian. But you decide to make a play, which means you've got to find the drama. Where's the drama?
Well, it just so happened that at the same time as I'm embarking on this search for my great-grandfather, my own father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And then, so there's a, and I'm incredibly close to my own father. So then there was this sort of, I guess, gradual deterioration of my father and the gradual loss of his memory. So I also started to write about my father and document over the last few years my father's dementia and what that's meant, and then his relationship with my son. So I kind of end up telling the stories of lots of family members, both past, because I unearthed some very interesting characters, including my great-grandfather. And then there's also characters in the present. So there's, I do play my father, and I do to some extent tell his story, some of the story of my own son, some of my own stories. So actually it ended up being a weaving together of stories from the past and the present.
Okay, so here we are now in the theatre and you're rehearsing, and I saw a run of this play, I don't know, was it 18 months ago?
Yeah. So about 18 months ago, one of the great things that La Mama offers is the chance for a new work to have a mini-season. It's called Explorations, and it happens every year, and it just means that new work can be tested in front of an audience. Because I know for me as a writer, because really I'm primarily a performer, I need to put things in front of an audience to understand whether they resonate or not. And it was great to just put that piece in its very early stages before an audience and get lots and lots of feedback.
Okay. Why don't we hear a bit? What would you like to perform for us?
Well, maybe I'll perform a section that actually just talks about my particular connection to Ireland and also my weakness for Irish men. Over the last 18 years, I have had 7 visits to Ireland. The country gets to me. It gets in under my skin, into my heart, my blood, my bones, my soul. Firstly, there is the landscape that completely takes my breath away. Then there is the music that gets to a place deep inside. Then there are the accents that are sublimely poetic. And finally, there are the men that I have a ridiculous weakness for. So if you were to put me in a pub in a particularly beautiful part of Ireland, where they happen to be playing traditional Irish music, and seat me beside an Irishman, well, I'd have no chance. Do you mind if we join you? Where are you from? What brings you to Ireland? How long are you staying in Dingle? Can I get you another drink? They ask me questions. But I encourage them to speak, and to keep on speaking, on and on. I'm at a table with 5 Irishmen. Heaven. I can barely sit still. My cheeks are still red from the bike ride around the beautiful coast of Dingle, right down in the south of Ireland. Their words are like a balm, cleansing me, whispering to me, lulling me into a state of absolute surrender. I no longer hear words, just sounds, beautiful sounds.
We're going on to another pub. Would you like to join us?
Yes, I would. A crowded pub in the tiny town of Doolin, on the west coast of Ireland. I'm watching the singer with the big blue eyes. He smiles at me and gives me a wink.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have an announcement to make. I have finally found the girl that I am going to marry.
The pub cheers loudly as he points to me. Then one of the locals says, "You be careful with that one now.
Shall we go for a drive?"
Yes. Then there's Philip, the actor who takes me back to his home in Stony Batter in Dublin, also known as Lovey Batter because so many actors live there. And Martin, in Derry in the north, who takes me home to his parents' house, where we sit around the fire and they tell me stories of life during the Troubles. And the beautiful boy at the youth hostel in Galway, who takes me back to stay with his family in lovely Connemara. And Patrick, in Glencolum Keel in the far northwest, who's a photographer, who introduces me to the rugged beauty of Donegal. Then there's Hayden,
The doctor with the fancy car and house with a pool in Hollywood in County Down, who gives me a tour of his house and kisses me in his wine cellar. And Marty, the singer, who I meet in Belfast and then again in Derry. Yes, 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 yes. Because the answer is always yes when an Irishman is asking the question.
So what are the challenges that you've faced dramatically here? You've got this very personal story and you have to make us care. I mean, why should I care about your family history? That's the question the audience is going to ask.
I think that's a really good question. And I think that was one of the great things about having the chance to do the piece for Explorations, because I remember wondering that beforehand, you know, is this even a play? Is this something that anyone would pay money for? And the feedback was fantastic, and we asked really specific feedback. We got about 65 pages of feedback from various audience members. And the bizarre thing was that it was remarkably similar. People were very clear about which moments of the play really they connected with and wanted to see more of, and they were very clear about where they got lost. And that was one of the things that I learned about if you're trying to recreate history and historical facts, people, you have to be really careful that it's not a history lecture. And so we worked out, all right, so we have to find really dramatic ways to tell those stories, so to recreate that story of Owen Roe O'Neill and the 1642 Irish Revolution. So I think Glynis and I have really played with how to make that very, very dramatic. And so we've imagined, you know, so have these great moments being Owen Roe O'Neill, leading this rebellion, which is great fun. And we have a wonderful sound designer, Darius Kedros, who's got these incredible sounds happening. And so it's great fun leading an Irish rebellion. And so we just had to really be very imaginative and dramatic and find the fun in it, find the pleasure in those moments of history, as opposed to just giving dry facts. I mean, I remember a thing for me about doing the thing for Explorations was really not knowing whether the story of my own father and his dementia was a valid part of this story. And people really did connect to that, though. And that was a big learning curve for me, because I wasn't, that was the bit of the show that I wasn't sure whether people connected with or not, because it's probably the most personal part of the show. But actually, I found that for many people, that isn't something that they're closely connected to. The experience of seeing someone that they love deteriorate, and how you continue to have a relationship with someone through their dementia. Actually, we've expanded on that, and that has become a really key part of that story. And that was something that I wasn't necessarily expecting. And I think that the fact that La Mama gave us this chance to test it in front of an audience, the audiences are incredibly generous with their feedback, and that really informed going forward. So the next 18 months of work that we've done on the play has been informed by what the audience told us.
Well, all the very best with it. Chookers for opening night. It's been lovely to come and share your rehearsal space with you. I'll let you get back to work.
Thanks, Michael.
And I recorded that conversation a few days ago. That work's now come to fruition. Vanessa O'Neill's show is called In Search of Owen Roe, and it opens this very night. That's the 25th of June, and it runs through until the 5th of July. It's directed by Glynis Angel, and details for that are on our website. Now, let's talk about podcasting, because you must have friends who love reading, who love the arts, but who don't listen to the show. They can't listen to the show because they're at work or they're doing stuff at the weekends. So if you do them a favour, or if you'd like to do them a favour, just tell them about the show and encourage them to podcast it. Just download the audio from our website. It's very, 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 very simple. Friday is the last Friday of the month, and you know what that means. It's the Subcontinent Book Club, and our book for June is A House for Mr. Biswas by V.S. Naipaul. It's big. It's sort of funny. Kind of sad too, and you and I will be discussing it when we gather for the book club. Now, if you've read the book, I'd love to know what you make of it, what your take-home insight is about this book. If you head along to the Books and Arts website, you can share your thoughts about the novel there. Just click on the picture that's labelled Subcontinent Book Club. There on the, what is it, the right-hand side of the page, all those hands leaning out with herbs and spices in them. It's a lovely picture. And I'll read out some of those comments on the show on Friday. Now, tonight, there's a very special program which I think will be of interest to you. It's on Big Ideas at 8 o'clock tonight. It's a very forceful and comprehensive assessment of the state of the arts in Australia from the media and arts executive Kim Williams, who says that arts policy is stagnating, that standards are in decline, and that it's time for the arts community to stop being bland
to back what is bold, make bold work. So do stay in tune for that one, or tune in for that one. That's tonight here on RN, Big Ideas at 8 o'clock. Tomorrow on the show, a very special edition, we'll be meeting the Dutch author Tommy Wieringa, whose latest novel tackles the people smuggling issue, the refugee issue in Eastern Europe. That's a very powerful conversation coming up on the show tomorrow. We're coming up to the news, and then it's Earshot and a show called Banjo Picking Girls and Fiddlin' Woman. The country music of Kentucky is rich, but traditionally it does not include women. Today we hear how three young girls, Cousin Emmy, Lily Mae Ledford and Molly O'Day, broke down the powerful prohibitions to become country music stars. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Bye-bye.